Lecture 20, Building Scenes.
Writers approach the day-to-day process of composition in many different ways. They differ in their aesthetic approach, they differ in temperament, they differ in willpower and discipline. And of course, what approach you take each day depends on the balance between the overall shape of your narrative and the needs of the particular passage you're working on. Writers also differ on what each one considers to be the fundamental unit of writing fiction. Some writers conceptualize the whole narrative in terms of plot points. Some writers think in terms of character arcs. Some think in terms of the larger ideas they want to get across, and so on. Some writers focus mainly on crafting elegant sentences. In a famous interview in the Paris Review, the Russian novelist Vladimir Nabokov claimed to write novels the way someone might fill in a crossword puzzle. He paid no particular attention to chronology, at least to begin with. Instead, he wrote a few sentences at a time on index cards and then assembled the cards later into a narrative. But no matter how you approach the day-to-day process, every writer, even Nabokov, is eventually faced with the prospect of making the whole thing hang together. We'll talk about that in our next two lectures, when we look at how the processes of composition and revision go hand in hand. But right now, I want to talk about what a writer does each day. And for me, that means creating individual scenes. What exactly do I mean by a scene? As I had discussed at length in my previous lectures about evocation and pacing, most narratives are divided between passages of exposition, in which the author summarizes the information the reader needs to know, and fully dramatized passages, which include action, dialogue, and setting. It's these dramatized passages that I'll be talking about, even though some of what I'll say applies to expository passages as well. In his book, The Art of Fiction, John Gardner defines a scene as everything that is included in an unbroken flow of action from one incident in time to another. According to Gardner, this unbroken flow of action can include movement through space from one place to another, as long as there isn't a big jump in time. In other words, a scene shows more or less everything that happens to a character, or between two or more characters, during a discrete span of time. In order to qualify as a scene in this definition, there can't be any interruptions in the flow of that time, except for flashbacks or brief passages of exposition. Of course, there are many different types of scene. For example, there are brief scenes that last only a few sentences and feature only a few characters in a narrowly defined setting, such as the opening scene of Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find. On a larger scale, there are epic scenes that go on for many pages and show many characters doing many things in a huge setting, such as the vast battle scenes in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. There are scenes that are merely transitional. There are scenes that are pivotal moments in the plot. There are scenes where nothing happens but the thoughts of a single character. There are scenes where all the characters do is talk to each other, and there are scenes which are full of violent, thrilling action. There are also scenes within scenes, which I'll talk about later in this lecture. As I said in my lecture on pacing, it is usually pretty easy to decide what you should make into a scene as opposed to what you should reveal through exposition. In other words, what you choose to dramatize rather than summarize. As I also said last time, you usually want to dramatize the most important or interesting parts of the story, and rely on exposition to get across the necessary but less interesting information. If you simply want the reader to know a bit of backstory, that's exposition. But if you want to have the reader experience something along with the characters, that's a scene. Way back in my lecture about evocation, I said that scenes in which the readers vicariously participate are much more vivid and memorable than passages in which they are simply told something. If you want the reader to remember something, have it happen right in front of her. A good example of this distinction comes from Alice Munro's story, The Beggar Maid, which, as you may recall, is about the courtship, marriage, and eventual divorce of two young Canadians, Rose and Patrick. As you may also recall, the story takes 30 pages to cover the first 8 months of their relationship, and then summarizes their subsequent marriage, divorce, and final meeting in the last 3 pages of the story. For most of the story's first 25 pages, Monroe shifts effortlessly between exposition and little bits of drama, often within the same paragraph. In fact, most of the dramatized bits only go on for a paragraph or two. At the end of those first 25 pages, however, Monroe gives us a fully dramatized scene. It's the scene in which Rose shows up at Patrick's room early in the morning and tells him she doesn't want to marry him. This scene goes on for 3.5 pages, which is a lot of real estate in a 33-page story. Monroe chooses to give this scene more time than any other scene in the story because it is the most dramatic moment in Rose and Patrick's relationship, showing them at their most raw and intimate. It also sets up the startling reversal in the next, much shorter scene, when Rose's resolve weakens and she decides to marry him after all, leading both herself and Patrick into years of misery. In other words, the scene in which Rose breaks up with Patrick is the heart of the story. This is why Monroe lets this moment play out in real time in front of the reader. Without it, the rest of the story simply wouldn't have the same impact. This particular scene also illustrates another important point about scenes in general. An individual scene needs to do at least 2 things at the same time. It needs to advance the larger narrative, and it needs to be interesting in its own right. In other words, a writer needs to balance the scene's position in the whole story with its own inherent drama. And one way to achieve this balance is to remember that a scene should be no longer than it needs to be in order to serve its purpose within the story as a whole. Please note that I'm not saying that a scene should necessarily be short, efficient, and economical, but rather that no individual scene should go on so long that a reader begins to wonder why she's still reading it. The length of a scene depends on the narrative as a whole, as well as the inherent interest of the individual scene. But these two balanced intentions can vary enormously from one narrative to another. Take George Pelicanos's hard-boiled detective novel, The Cut, for example. This is a fast-paced narrative written with efficiency and economy. Even so, its young detective, Spiro Lucas, occasionally takes time out from the case he's working on to have an erotic interlude with a young woman. In fact, over the course of the book, he strings along 2 different women, because he's that kind of guy. These brief scenes about his love life add complexity to the character, and they serve to tell us something we wouldn't otherwise know about Spiro. But because they aren't central to the story, they tend to be much shorter and more expository than the scenes that actually advance the investigation. Pelicanos properly devotes more space and detail and dramatic energy to those scenes in which Spiro is interviewing a witness or stalking a suspect. On the other hand, in a more expansive, less plot-driven narrative such as Ulysses or Moby Dick, a scene can go on for pages simply because it is inherently interesting. These novels are more interesting for the quality of their language, the richness of the world being evoked, or the inherent interest of the subject matter than they are for the story. In Moby Dick, Herman Melville devotes long passages and even whole chapters to describing the work of a whaling vessel, the natural history of whales, and other topics that don't advance the plot. However, these scenes still advance the overall purpose of the book. They evoke an entire way of life in as much detail as possible, but they aren't necessarily concerned with advancing a story. And with some books, the point of the novel isn't the plot at all, but the individual scenes that make up the plot. With your indulgence, I'll offer up one of my own novels, The Lecturer's Tale, as an example. Now, this book does have a plot. It's about a failing academic named Nelson, who uses a supernatural power to rise through the English department of a fictional Midwestern university. But the purpose of the book wasn't necessarily to tell a story, but to allow me to make fun of the worst excesses of modern literary theory. As I was writing it, I realized that the book was basically a series of satirical set pieces, each one of which was more over the top than the one before. These set pieces weren't entirely self-contained, since each one did push my silly plot a little further along. But each chapter or scene was mainly intended to be amusing for its own sake. It became clear to me early on that the point of the plot was to set up the scenes, not the other way around. One of the plot points in the lecturer's tale is the fact that Nelson's department has a job opening. And even though Nelson isn't qualified for the position, he decides to sabotage the three main candidates. So in a chapter entitled The Three Stooges, Nelson uses his supernatural power to get each candidate to embarrass him or herself. The chapter is made up of three major scenes, and in each scene, one of the job candidates self-destructs in public. The second scene, for example, features a charismatic Englishman who studies popular culture. And I had him deliver a lecture in which he deconstructs an Elvis Presley movie called Viva Vietnam. When somebody in the audience of the lecture points out that such a movie never existed, I had the Englishman argue that it didn't matter whether the movie existed or not. What mattered was his analysis. The satirical target of this scene was academics who put literary criticism above actual works of art, but part of my incentive for writing it was simply to amuse myself and, I hope, the reader. And so, it became an extended comic riff on a fake Elvis Presley movie set in Vietnam, complete with fake Elvis Presley song titles like Dien Bien Phui, You Broke My Heart of Darkness, and The Moonlight, The Minefield, and You. I easily could have shown the Englishman's self-destruction in a much shorter scene, but it wouldn't have been as much fun. My point here is that how long a scene goes on, and whether it should be included at all, does not depend on the plot necessarily, but on the intent of the narrative as a whole. A plot-driven crime novel like The Cut needs to move through the water like a shark. If it slows down, it dies. Trying to squeeze in a long chapter about the history of detective work or Spiro Lucas's history with women would throw the whole novel out of whack. On the other hand, The Lecturer's Tale has a different metabolism than a thriller. You're not meant to race through it the way you read a novel like The Cut. You're meant to enjoy each scene as it comes. As a result, the scenes in that book are longer and slower than the scenes in The Cut. The scenes in each book have a different pace and structure because the intent of each book is different. Transitioning into and out of a scene is something that vexes some writers, even experienced ones. These transitions can vary enormously, depending on the intent of the scene, its length, its importance in the narrative, and so on. For example, scenes that take place early in the narrative are going to need more of a setup on the whole than scenes that appear later. When you're introducing characters, situations, or settings for the first time, you need to spend more time describing them than you do later on, when the reader already knows who the character is or what the setting looks like. You can take your time in these scenes. You can describe the setting and the character in some detail and let the characters talk a bit more digressively than they might in later scenes. For example, in the very first paragraph of The Maltese Falcon, Dashiell Hammett gives us a detailed physical description of his detective, Sam Spade. You may recall that Spade is described as looking like a blonde Satan. Hammett provides this detailed and evocative description first thing, so that later on, he can just start a scene with Spade's name or some action or gesture without having to tell us all over again what he looks like. The same goes for Spade's office. Having described it once, Hammett doesn't need to do it again, unless some particular feature of the setting needs to be pointed out for a particular purpose in that particular scene. For example, if Hammett wants to make it clear that a scene is happening in Spade's office at sunset, he might start the scene by saying something like, "The last light of the sun slanted through the slats of the blinds." There's no need for him to describe everything in the office again. Also, short scenes need less of an introduction than longer, more dramatic scenes. You can signal the start of a new scene with something as simple as a space break in the text, or, if time has passed since the last section, with a simple phrase like "the next day" or "a few hours later." On the other hand, if the scene is going to be longer or more important or more dramatic, you might want to make more of a fuss at the start. Alice Munro begins that significant scene in The Beggar Maid, the one in which Rose breaks up with Patrick, with a description of Rose's walk from her room to Patrick's apartment. She woke up early, got up, and dressed, and let herself out the side door of Dr. Henshaw's garage. It was too early for the buses to be running. She walked through the city to Patrick's apartment. She walked across the park. Around the South African War Memorial, a pair of greyhounds were leaping and playing, an old woman standing by holding their leashes. The sun was just up, shining on their pale hides. The grass was wet. Daffodils and narcissus were in bloom. As I said earlier, most of the story before this point moves at a brisk pace. This paragraph immediately slows down the narrative and lets us know that something important is about to happen. It provides a bumper between the fast-paced mixture of exposition and miniature scenes that came immediately before it and the slower and more dramatic scene that's about to start. After that little prologue, Munro lets the encounter between Rose and Patrick play out before the reader in more or less real time. But then she ends the scene abruptly and dramatically, befitting the emotionally turbulent nature of the encounter, as Rose storms out of Patrick's apartment. "I don't want to see you, ever," she said viciously. But at the door she turned and said in a normal and regretful voice, "Goodbye." After easing us into the scene and letting it play out in front of the reader, Munro then cuts the scene off as sharply as Rose cuts off her relationship with Patrick. It's a skillful mimetic effect, evoking the same shock in the reader that both Rose and Patrick must feel at that moment. Another way to transition into a scene is to begin it in medias res, which, as I've mentioned in an earlier lecture, is a Latin expression that means in the middle of things. This is one of the oldest and most reliable tricks in a fiction writer's repertoire, namely, starting a scene in the middle of the action, or at least after the action of the scene is already underway. The chief advantage of entering a scene already in progress is that it adds energy and urgency to the narrative. It also engages the reader on a deeper level by forcing him to sit up and pay attention to what's going on. It's as if he's walked into a lively party full of interesting people that started an hour before he got there. In fact, this is exactly what happens in the opening sequence of Eleanor Catton's epic historical mystery, The Luminaries. In her bravura opening chapter, Catton introduces us to a character named Walter Moody, who has just arrived at a remote gold rush community on the west coast of New Zealand in 1866. In the opening pages of the book, he finds himself in a hotel lounge with 12 other men. He has never met any of these men before, but they proceed to tell him a long, complicated story about a suspicious death, a suicide attempt, and the discovery of a fortune in gold, all of which happened weeks before Moody even showed up. By throwing both Moody and the reader into the deep end of the pool, Catton risks making the reader feel overwhelmed the way Moody does himself at first. But she constructs that opening scene so energetically and with such attention to detail that she hooks us into the mystery that isn't even fully explained until 800 pages later. Now, when it comes to making a transition from one scene to another, usually you can accomplish it without any fuss. Here's another example from The Beggar Maid. This is a brief passage that starts as exposition and shifts suddenly into a little bit of drama. It comes during a sequence where Patrick has taken Rose back to British Columbia to meet his family. The sisters Joan and Marion were younger than Patrick, older than Rose. Unlike Patrick, they showed no nervousness, no cracks in self-satisfaction. At an earlier meal, they had questioned Rose. "Do you ride?" "No." "Do you sail?" "No." "Play tennis? Play golf? Play badminton?" "No, no, no." Here, two simple expository sentences about Patrick's sisters lead immediately, with hardly any transition, into a brief scene in which we can hear, in only 17 words, Joan and Marion's snobbery and Rose's embarrassment. Transitioning out of a scene is perhaps a little less vexing than transitioning into one. Again, it depends on the scene's purpose and the narrative as a whole, But in general, you can round off a scene more briskly than you can start one. Once the main purpose of the scene is played out, the new character has been sufficiently introduced, the plot point has been made, you usually want to wrap it up as quickly as possible, but without coming across like a host pushing his guests out the door. For some kinds of narrative, you might end a scene with a sort of punchline, a witticism from the character, or even a sudden revelation. But even with narratives that aren't driven by plot, you don't want to linger over the scene after its purpose has been fulfilled. As I said earlier, there can also be transitions within a scene, such as when a writer pauses to provide some exposition or segues into a flashback. Eleanor Catton's The Luminaries is made up mostly of long, dramatized scenes. But because the plot is so complicated, she often has to pause the action to introduce an extended flashback that lasts for many pages before returning to the original scene. Because The Luminaries is written in the style of a 19th century novel, sometimes Catton directly addresses the reader in a formal manner that calls attention to the transition itself. We shall therefore intervene and render Suk Yong Sheng's story in a way that is accurate to the events he wished to disclose, rather than to the style of his narration. At other times, she slips effortlessly from drama to exposition with hardly any transition at all. The entire passage is too long to quote here, but here are the beginning and the end of an important piece of exposition about Walter Moody, which comes in the middle of a conversation Moody is having with a character named Gascoigne. The two men are discussing a prostitute named Anna, who has been wearing another woman's clothes for reasons that are too complicated for me to explain. Here's how the scene transitions from drama to exposition. "Mr. Gascoigne," Moody said, holding up his hand, "despite my youth, I possess a certain store of wisdom about the fairer sex, and I can categorically tell you that women do not like it when other women wear their clothes without their asking." Gascoigne laughed. Cheered by this joke, he applied himself to finishing his luncheon with a renewed energy and a good humor. The truth of Moody's observation notwithstanding, it must be owned that his store of wisdom, as he had termed it, could be called empirical only in that it had been formed upon the close observation of his late mother, his stepmother, and his two maternal aunts. To put it plainly, Moody had never taken a lover and did not know a great deal about women. After this, there are nearly two pages of Moody's history with women, particularly his lack of experience with prostitutes. Then, two pages later, this exposition transitions back to the scene's present moment, with Moody addressing Gascoigne again. The truth was that he had never spoken two words together to a woman of Anna Wetherell's profession or experience, and would hardly know how to address her, or upon what subject, should the chance arise. "And of course," he said now, "we ought to be cheered by the fact that Miss Wetherell's trunk did not follow her to the wayfarer's fortune." "Did it not?" said Gascoigne in surprise. The transition into exposition is simple. It happens with a paragraph break as the text jumps from Gascoigne's good humor to the beginning of the next sentence, the truth of Moody's observation notwithstanding. Then, at the end of the expository section, the transition back into drama is signaled with another paragraph break after the phrase, "should the chance arise." Then comes a line of dialogue beginning "and of course" and the adverb "now" after "he said." These further signal the reader that the exposition is over and we're back at luncheon with Moody and Gascoigne. The previous example was about pausing a scene to provide exposition, but there are also scenes within scenes, which are usually flashbacks. Getting in and out of flashbacks can be pretty straightforward as well. If it's a short flashback, you might signal the shift in time by putting the whole flashback in italics, but that can be cumbersome. Too many words in italics can bristle at a reader. An easier way to transition into a flashback, especially if it's from the point of view of a particular character, is simply to say something like, "Leo thought back to the conversation he'd had with Anna the day before," or "Leo remembered what Anna had said to him," or something like that. There's a more subtle way, though, which I have often used in my own work over the years. I've always thought that starting a flashback with Kevin remembered or Stella thought back to when was clunky and mechanical. It seems like the literary equivalent of a transition to a flashback in an old movie, the kind where the screen goes wavy or a newspaper headlines come spinning towards the camera. So instead, I usually try to signal a flashback with a simple change in verb tense. In my novel Next, my character Kevin spends much of the story thinking about his past. The present-day action of the novel is about Kevin's trip to Austin, Texas for a job interview, and those scenes are written in the present tense. His memories and flashbacks, on the other hand, are in the past tense. Sometimes the text just switches straight from the present tense to the past, as in this excerpt. Kevin is standing on a pedestrian bridge in Austin and thinking about his father, who died when he was a teenager. Now Kevin knows why his father sang melancholy Sinatra songs in the shower, and the memory of his father's bass baritone, too low for Sinatra, he strained for the high notes, unexpectedly tightens Kevin's throat. It kills him to think he never put it together, the difference between what his father sang when he was alone and thought no one could hear, and what he sang when he was harmonizing with his barbershop quartet buddies two Saturdays a month. As you can see, Kevin's thoughts are in the present tense, but his father's actions are in the past tense. This passage leads to a 2.5-page flashback about the death of Kevin's father, all of which takes place in the past tense. At the end of the flashback, a policeman speaks to the young Kevin with his dialogue tag in the past tense. Then, in the next sentence, we return to Kevin in the present day, and he is thinking in the present tense. "Are you Kevin?" the policeman said with surprising tenderness. "Wow," thinks Kevin on the bridge, and he palms the tears out of his eyes. "I don't need this now. I really, really don't. But there's no stopping it. 35 years later, the night of his father's death can still sneak up on him." Now, this technique won't work, of course, if the present day of your narrative is already in the past tense, which is the default verb tense of most fiction. In that case, you can signal a shift into the flashback by switching briefly into the past perfect tense. In that case, instead of saying, "Kevin's father sang Sinatra songs in the shower," you'd say, "Kevin's father had sung Sinatra songs in the shower." And then, to get out of the flashback and back to the present, you'd use a past perfect again just for a moment at the end. Instead of saying, "Are you Kevin?" the policeman said, you would write, "Are you Kevin?" the policeman had said, in order to signal the return to the main story. Let me give you a longer example. Here's a brief flashback scene from my first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, in which a character named Jimmy Coogan, who was a member of the Irish Republican Army, remembers the time he stole an expensive Macintosh raincoat from a shop in London. He started along the beach through a fine mist of sea spray, and he pulled the wide lapel of the Macintosh all the way across and buttoned it. The Mac was an expensive one, a Burberry. He had tried it on in a posh men's store in Bond Street, turning this way and that in front of the tall mirrors like a woman, while the clerk fussed around him and tugged at his cuffs. Coogan had no intention of taking it until he realized how his wife would scold him for it, and she did, telling him that it was his business to remain inconspicuous, that the Mac made him look like a bloody television correspondent. And even then, he had no intention of paying for it. He sent the man into the back for a box, and when the man was gone, he had slipped out the door as someone else came in. As this passage starts, Coogan started along the beach and buttoned his Macintosh in the past tense. But when he starts to remember how he stole it, the verb tense shifts into the past perfect. He had tried it on in a posh men's store. Then the bulk of the flashback takes place in the simple past tense because it was too awkward to write a long passage in the past perfect. Just like a long passage in italics, all those hads would bristle at a reader. Then, to signal the end of the flashback, I stick in one more instance of the past perfect. When the man was gone, he had slipped out the door, just before Jimmy returns to the present moment of the story. The effect is almost subliminal, and in principle anyway, the reader follows the shift into the flashback and out of it again without really having to think about it. So, to sum up, There are some scenes that are just little bursts of drama that can be truncated or incomplete, the way most of the early scenes in The Beggar Maid are. But most of the time, most of the weight in a narrative is carried by fully dramatized scenes. These major scenes are basically little stories within the story. Even if a major scene couldn't stand alone outside the context of a whole narrative, it should have the structure of a simple story, with a beginning, middle, and end. In an earlier lecture, I talked about fractals, the mathematical concept of a pattern that repeats itself at every level of magnification. Now, I'm not saying that each individual scene should necessarily reproduce the structure or plot of the larger narrative, but it helps to remember that any story made of scenes is basically made of smaller stories. It's stories all the way down. Now here's an exercise to help you think about crafting scenes. Take an undramatized moment from a story of your own or from a story or novel you admire, and turn it into a full-fledged dramatic scene. In other words, take a moment that is only alluded to or depicted only briefly in an expository passage and dramatize it fully. For example, the moment that Hamlet learns that his father has died is never shown in Shakespeare's play, so you might dramatize that. Take as many words or pages as you need and turn it into a little story with a beginning, middle, and end. Don't worry about how long it is. But you also want to make sure that it contributes to the larger narrative. This will give you practice in making a scene self-contained as well as making it an integral part of the larger story. In the meantime, in the next two lectures, we're going to explore how the process of composition and the process of revision are linked, and we'll also talk about how to think about your completed narrative as a whole.